the Business and Transportation Committee. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 461 and 463. James, Senator Przanski, what do we got?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 461 permits person to get replacement driver's license or driver permit if person dislikes photograph on current driver license or permit. There is no revenue impact, there is a minimal fiscal impact, and there are no amendments.
Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Floyd Przanski, State Senator for District 4. I'm here, we're taking testimony on 461 at this point. Oh, I'm here, or do you want me to?
We've got them both open. So
okay,
just
so let's just start off with 461. A constituent of mine by the name of Debbie Summers contacted our office and stated that she was wondering if there would be a process that she and others who would like to have their photograph that's on their DMV license to be replaced when they feel that it doesn't, you know, say, fairly represent them. And now knowing that we have a license renewal that's every 8 years, that when you get your license replaced, in the sense of if you lose it, they will use the same photograph that was originally taken. I, as a senator, as most of you, had a constituent that asked for this to go forward, so I welcomed her request and put the bill in forward. Now, I know that there's been a lot of discussion and interest regarding this as to efficiency for DMV, vainness of an individual who thinks they should have a better photograph or whatever it may be. I'm going to put, another situation on the table. The Ben Bulletin did do an editorial on this bill, and they were opposed to the bill. There was a letter to the editor that came from one of their readers that basically gave me a reason why I think that we should look at multiple reasons why it might be appropriate for an individual to have their photograph updated prior to 8 years running. You take a young man who is 16 years of age, gets his license, or a young woman age 16 gets their license, and at age 21, when they become able to partake in alcoholic beverages, they basically will have their license updated from where it says minor on the license, driver's license, to a new license that will take away that demarcation, but the photograph is the same. And as this gentleman, Mr. Lawrence Jones from Bend, stated, that a child who has their license issued at age 16 before age 24, which would be 8 years, has remarkable changes in their facial resemblance, and that it would be appropriate for them to be able to have their license updated. So I think there's really other reasons besides someone not liking their photo to have it updated. And personally, as a prosecutor, I think it makes sense that we should allow for situations where someone becomes of age that they that 5 years have passed or 4 years have passed since they've had their license photograph taken to be retaken. Now, clearly, I believe that there should be a cost incurred, and I would submit to this committee that the committee could take and take the step of requiring a person who wants to just have their photograph replaced charged at a higher rate than just a replacement for a driver's license to take in for the additional work that may be required from DMV. But I also will submit to you that I think there's other reasons besides just someone not liking their picture. As I mentioned, when you have youth that are going to have significant physical changes in their presence over an 8 year period. Now, my staff did check in to see about other opportunities when someone can have their license replaced and have a new photo replaced. My understanding, if you have an extreme difference in your haircut, that that in itself would be reasons to allow for someone's photograph to be updated. So it does seem like at this point DMV does make some exceptions. This would be just another one. And I do submit to you that if we are going to go down this path, that we should definitely be charging whatever the full freight would be to require that to be paid for that it would offset those costs and needs. And Ms. Summers asked me to present this information to the committee because she is, if I remember correctly, a teacher and was not able to make arrangements from her school to be able to come up personally. So, Mr. Chair, that's the testimony I present for Ms. Summers.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions on this bill? Seeing none, you want to go ahead and comment on 463 Center.
Yeah, yes, I'd be glad to. Again, Floyd Brzezinski, State Senator, District 4. Senate Bill 463 comes to you at the request of Wayne Allen, who's the municipal court judge for Eugene. This is a situation that he has seen multiple times in his courtroom where an individual who has a issue regarding their need to have tenant windows, and they are basically have a physical condition that requires them to have the windows tinted. What has happened is that if a person has that condition but they do not have with them paperwork, an affidavit actually, from the physician or optometrist stating that this is a requirement for them to be able to safely operate the motor vehicle, and they're stopped by a police officer, if they don't have the affidavit at the time of the stop, they receive a citation. Many individuals who receive that citation think, well, okay, this means I'm going to have to go to the court. I'll present to them the information I have, and they'll just dismiss the ticket. Unfortunately, that does not happen because the way the statute is written, because the limitations that courts have, Judge Allen believes he does not have the authority under current law to dismiss that ticket, even though the individual has gone and received some type of paperwork from their physician or optometrist. Also, I'm not sure if your committee administrator provided to you, but Mr. LeBar, but Judge Allen did note in his email to me and to Mr. LeBar that he thought that the current need for an affidavit is also maybe too formal and necessary, that instead having just something that would be on the doctor's letterhead that would state this would serve that same purpose, and it would not require the formality of an affidavit that is much more structured in a legal sense.
Senator, the question I would have, and I really don't have much about this, but if you had a member of the family that had that medical need, but it was the family car and, you know, their spouse or other family member was driving it, how would that work? You're not gonna take the tinting off, you know, obviously.
No, Mr. Chair, I think what would happen, what would be required to say not have a citation issued, is that they would have to have paperwork in the vehicle at the time they are pulled over and demonstrate that someone who is either the registered owner or someone that's a regular operator of that vehicle has this condition, and the vehicle is in fact used by that individual with that medical condition. That's the only way I could see that an officer would be, I'd say, not obligated to write the ticket. Of course, officers do have discretion. They could take that information from an individual without having the documentation, and if they chose to give the person a warning, so be it. But I would still think that there need to be some type of documentation in the vehicle to protect someone who's operating the vehicle.
I wonder if there's a way you could approach, get that kind of a letter, take it to DMV, and get a notation on a title or something, not a title, a registration.
Mr. Chair, I think that is another way of possibly solving this issue without talking directly to DMV. I know DMV is here today to make some general comments. That might be something that would be something that could be approached. I'm not sure as to how the workload would be for DMV as to where an individual may have multiple cars and doing it for each of the titles, but that would be another way to deal with it.
Okay, thank you. Question, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I read this law, it doesn't have anything to do with who's driving the car. It's who the car is registered to. They're the person who's liable and who's responsible. And so the fact that you're driving a car with tinted windows, I don't see that there is a citation even for driving a car with a tinted windows. It's for it has to do with the registered owner. Am I wrong about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, my understanding is the ticket is written for basically the window being tinted,
mm-hmm.
And it's issued to the driver of the vehicle at that time, not to a registered owner. So if I'm tracking your perspective on this, the individual who's operating the vehicle is the one that's going to be getting the ticket, and it is for the tinting of the window, and I believe it would be an equipment violation citation. I'm not sure exactly what would be written as to the what the violation is. If it is an equipment violation, I'm assuming they would cite the it looks like section 815.222, where it says a person commits the offense of illegal window tinting if the person applies, and it goes on from there.
Yeah.
So the citation is
right.
is for that offense, and you know when I took this issue up from the judge, it was basically he felt that there was a injustice that was occurring for individuals who actually had a legitimate physical condition, but they because they didn't have the paperwork with them at the time of the citation being issued, there was no way for them to be able to undo that issue. Many times courts in equity will in fact make those calls right there. A very good example is an individual who cited for not having insurance. If you don't have insurance at the time that you're cited, in the sense of proof of insurance, I should say, a citation will be, in many cases, given to the individual. If the individual goes to court and shows and demonstrates that they actually had insurance at the time of the citation, the court will just automatically dismiss. And I think this is what the frustration for Judge Allen is, that he does not feel under the current structure of the language of the bill, excuse me, of the law, that he does not have that discretion.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Senator, we'll let you get back to work.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for taking my testimony out of order.
Thank you. And we will recess the hearing, public hearing on Senate Bills 461, 463, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 623. James?
Senate Bill 623 eliminates malt beverage and wine production restriction on winery licensee or person having interest in winery licensee that requires full on-premise sales license. We do have an amendment here, dash one, clarifies that the elimination of the production restriction only applies to wineries. There is no revenue impact and there is no fiscal impact.
Welcome to the committee, Jim.
Chairman, members.
We understand you have a conflict for sort of taking it out of order here, so.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Jim Bruno. I'm the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards. And I appreciate very much you hearing this bill today. When this bill was first, the law was first drafted, there was no one in our industry under the limits of the measure that's in the statute. We now produce 267,000 gallons, or at least this last year we did, which puts us now outside of that limit established first in the law. And I think it was just something that wasn't anticipated. For those of you who've been to Willamette Valley Vineyards, you understand we're highly collaborative with other fermentation science industries, and we conduct a lot of activities that not only include wine, but also our colleagues in other fermentation sciences. Because of our growth, we're now outside the statutory provisions of the law, and we just ask you to remove the limit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, attorney in Portland with the Romaine Group, and I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. With the Dash 1 amendments, we support what Mr. Bruno is attempting to do. It's simply limits it to wine wineries. The issue with breweries is far more complicated given the purchase of a brewery in the state by a major, very large, humongous brewer that's not in the state. So it just makes it a little more complicated. So if you limit it to wineries, that's really the issue, and we would be just fine with it. It's just weird being up here supporting Jim.
Okay, so we got a dash one, and any questions, either gentleman? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I've got it open. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? No? Nobody else wishes to testify?
Let's go to work session.
So we will, last chance, anybody? No? We'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 623. The chair moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 623. Discussion on that motion.
What does it do?
It limits. It limits it only to wine and not beer.
It's just a clarifying amendment that it removes the elimination of the production restriction, and it only applies to wineries.
Only to wineries.
Okay. Only to wineries. Beer comes later. Any other discussion? Is there any opposition? There's none. Dash ones are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 623 as amended by the Dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, Senate Bill 623 as amended by the Dash ones is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. And who wants to carry? Okay. Senator Girard would like to carry that bill. So we'll close on Senate Bill 623. Now we're going to move back up to the top of the agenda. So we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 424.
Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 424 allows retail, non-retail, or wholesale dealer to sell or offer gasoline that is not blended with ethanol if gasoline is used for use in motorcycles. There are no amendments. There is a minimal revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Mr. Romaine.
There's other people that...
Oh, you want them to go first? We can do that. Mr. Hickman and Mr. Tiller?
I tried to sign up below them.
So you want to shoot later?
No, I'm with them. I'll come up with them. Cool. They need to explain it. I'm here to lend moral support.
Okay.
I'm not sure that's a plus these days.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chairman Byer, members of the committee, Senator Girard. My name is Doug Tiller. I represent ABATE of Oregon, Oregon's Motorcycle Clubs, independent riders, and other riding organizations. We also work closely with the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety. And as with the marine and aviation emergency vehicles, ethanol reduces fuel efficiency, shortens lifespan, and the safety of our engines. Many vehicle warranties warn against the use of this type of fuel. And we support the idea of finding alternative ways to reduce emissions without the extra expense of maintenance or our safety on the road.
Sir.
Hi. I own a local motorcycle.
Your name, please.
David Hickerson.
Well, thank you.
And so I'm here to talk about the safety concerns that I've seen firsthand. And one thing that happened to my wife personally, there's a little rubber tip on the shutoff valve in a carburetor. Well, that's one of the first things to go. Alcohol dissolves rubber, and I kept telling her to shut the fuel valve off, and one day she forgot. I went out in the shop, and there's 5 gallons of gasoline all over the floor. Well, it was a cleanup problem for me, but imagine that happening in a closed garage and someone had a gas-fired furnace that lit off, you know, as an extreme example. But the degradation happened so quickly. I was tuning a motorcycle one time, and I sent the gentleman home to do some testing. He came back 2 days later. I took the float ball off, and the O-ring expanded to a degree where you couldn't get it back in. You know, it happens real quick. Fuel lines get soft, start degrading inside, and it plugs up the whole system. And not just with carbureted. It happens with fuel injected, late model fuel injected. I have seen the filter inside the gas tank disintegrate inside, plug up the system, and the diagnostics on the machine aren't designed to present a code for that. So they're back and back and back and back trying to figure out what goes on with it till finally somebody pulls the guts out of the fuel tank and fixes it. But the problems go on and on and on. Alcohol is will make aluminum brittle, grows corrosion on it. It's real hard on copper, which is what jets and metering orifices are made of. So, you know, ethanol will ultimately destroy any mechanical device. It's just that the smaller they are, the quicker it happens. You know, you take a flex fuel vehicle, the microprocessor tells it what fuel to air ratio to use, but it doesn't, you can't do anything about metallurgy and chemistry. So it's going to happen. For instance, alcohol will pull moisture right out of the air. So modern cars, they have a sealed vent system, but they don't stay sealed very long. And I have seen pools of water develop in the bottom of the gas tank, and the first time you know about it is when there's gas leaking out of the bottom of the car as you're driving down the road. So it's a big safety problem for everyone, but us in the motorcycle world, it happens real quick, and it's a big problem.
I don't even know where to begin. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the with the Romaine Group, and we represent the Oregon Fuels Association. We sell all the different fuels. We're the dealers and the jobbers in the state. We support this, the exemption. Again, it's really funny, the bills that have 24 at the end of them, but they seem to be dealing with ethanol. But it is an issue that people have to face, that ethanol, while being a fuel, is not as efficient, has a lot of different issues. Doesn't mean it shouldn't be used. It just means we have to face up to the fact that we're going to have to do something about this stuff. And we support the motorcycle folks who want to be able to use clear. Now, again, clear is not available everywhere, and it's usually far more expensive because it is a boutique fuel. On the coast, it's about a buck and a half more per gallon. But just because it's a boutique fuel and you can't use it in an automobile. So you're not allowed. You can use it. You're just not allowed to put it into an automobile.
Senator Monroe.
Now, wouldn't this, I've heard of people having troubles with their lawnmowers and trying to get ethanol-free fuel to run their lawnmowers. If this was available for motorcycles, I would assume people that needed it for lawnmowers could access it as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, there is already an exemption for tools, including but not limited to lawnmowers, leaf blowers, and chainsaws. That's in the original legislation. We, in our rush to do ethanol, we tried to anticipate many things. We didn't anticipate everything, and I'm sure there's a lot of other stuff out there that will be back. People will be back saying, please let us go. But
yeah,
it's in the current law.
Saying it's exempt, in other words, you don't have to use it, and having it available, those are two different things.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I believe that argument was made about a week ago.
Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 424? That's all I had signed up.
Yeah, sure.
We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 424. Chair moves Senate Bill 424 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion.
If the low carbon fuel standards doesn't pass, there's no need for this bill. So.
No, they're saying the existing.
I'm hoping.
E10. All right.
So does that just mean trying to point
does
it
that
out.
Mean you're going to be a no on this?
No, I'm a yes. Of course I'm a yes.
Any other discussion on this bill? All righty. Is there anybody in opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 424 passes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. You want to carry it?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Thompson carries. We'll close on that. And let's see. Now we'll... Amy's not here, so I'm going to move down to, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 583. James.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate Bill 583 allows a brewery public house licensee to import malt beverages for which licensee controls brand, permits brewery public house licensee to hold off-premise sales license if they wholly own the off-premise sale license, or if the brewery public house licensee does not exercise control or participate in the business decisions or influence the sales or purchases of the off-premise sales license to disadvantage a competitor's liquor brand. establishes 9-member Oregon Spirits Board to support Oregon distilled liquor industry, directs board to operate state distilled liquor room, directs board to create and maintain long-term strategic plan to guide allocation of funds and award grants, establishes Oregon Spirits Board Fund with monies and fund continuously appropriated to the board for its use, directs Oregon Liquor Control Commission to withhold for payment to board 1 to 4 cents per bottle of distilled spirits sold, depending on volume of bottle, allows Oregon Liquor Control Commission to appoint a distillery licensee to serve as distillery retail outlet agent for another licensed distiller, allows distillers to enter into compensation agreement for a licensed distiller to act as retail outlet agent for another distiller, allows distillery licensee to make retail sales and pour tastings of another distiller's product if the licensee is the appointed retail outlet agent for the other distiller, allows distillery licensee holding special event license to pour tastings and sell by the glass and bottle another licensed distiller's product for which is appointed to retail outlet agent, declares emergency effective upon passage. We do have two amendments. The dash two amendment deletes the Oregon Spirits Board and the distillery portions of the bill and maintains the brewery public house licensee portion. The dash three amendment modifies reporting process to a quarterly basis for a person holding a direct shipper permit of wine or cider. We have no statements, whether it be revenue or fiscal, issued for the bill or either amendments.
Statements. Ted, please. Welcome.
Welcome. My name's Ted Pappas. I'm the owner of Big Bottom Distilling out of Hillsboro. I'm also the president of the Oregon Distillers Guild. Thank you, Senator Beyer, for allowing me to speak. Kind of odd to actually speak on something saying take it out, but that's essentially what the Dash 1 is doing. We are doing that for one reason and one reason alone. There are two HBs already in process, HB 2567 and 2568, that are underway that we, to be honest, just were worked on a little bit longer, and we've been able to get to language to where we need to be. Both of these are imperative, I believe, to the continued growth of our industry. And the only story that I will share with you is this past 2 weeks ago, I was in Austin, Texas for the American Craft Spirits Association, which is essentially our national trade organization for the more mature distilleries. But they have a tight tie-in to the distillery guilds within all the states. I was very proud to sit there and to say that we were the first distillery guild in the country. Started in 2007, and was also very proud to say that we have a close relationship with the OLCC and our state lawmakers, and are looking at passing the first spirits board, which that is HB 2568. So I'm asking this committee to go ahead and approve the dash one, to remove the language out of there, and then I would look for everyone's support when these two bills come over from the House. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you got.
Did we say there's a dash two as well?
Yes. I think the amendment Ted's talking about is the dash two.
Oh, is it the dash two?
Yes, that's the...
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the dash two. Thank you. For the
you
record.
You don't want
yeah.
the dash ones.
So yeah. The dash two is the one that removes the...
There's
it was kind of a last-minute thing that we did.
Okay. Cool. Questions? Yes.
In the bill, it has language... that allows a brewery public house license to import malt beverages. So why do you have to import malt beverages? When, you know, those kind of industries are here, we're supporting our, we have plenty of those businesses here. Why do you need to import it?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, I hope there's someone from the brewing industry to answer that question for you, because I'm just the spirits guy.
Okay. Hold that question.
I will.
Thank you, Ted.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Romaine. I bet you're the guy to answer that question.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine at the Romaine Group. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. The question that you presented, Senator Thompson, was an interesting one, because that's the same question we had about this. And what we are requesting is that you kind of hold on this bill or let people kind of work over some amendments. The whole theory behind a brew pub is that the beer is brewed here. And what's happened now is some folks are actually brewing some beer, contract brewing it in, say, Washington State, and then importing it back, or they want to bring it back in. Now, that's not exactly what a brew pub license was supposed to be for. And really what has to happen at this point, as those of you who have been around the alcohol business for a while on this committee, there's a big mix and match of different things that people can do. And it used to be we'd do little exceptions here and there to try and make it work, and we were quite good at it. What we did with the beer industry was nothing short of remarkable. We started off with everybody saying absolutely no, and gradually we led ourselves to the place we are today where we're known for our beer. Same thing with wine, although that was a little more dramatic. They went off a lot quicker. But we're now reaching the point where other players are starting to come in and maybe trying to take advantage of the situation, and we have to be careful about the kind of licenses and what we allow those licenses to do. So we would ask that you give us a couple of weeks, bring this bill back, and obviously the amendment that takes out the distillery stuff is great. That's fine, and we support what they're trying to do. They're really good people, and it's a fledgling industry, and they're actually doing a very good job out there. But the rest of the stuff, we really need a little more time to kind of distill what we need.
Distill what we need.
Yeah.
Okay. Questions are answered?
Oh, we asked for that same thing on the clean fuels bill, and they didn't wait. So why would they wait for you guys?
Don't mix clients.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
It's really bad. Else?
I think it's a great idea.
It would brew a controversy.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, not sure why the Treasury has an issue here, but I'm sure you're going to tell us.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Drew Johnston with the Oregon State Treasury. We're in support of the Dash 2s. It removes the board. There's a few technical concerns we had after reviewing the bill about how it directed the state treasurer to pay some accounts, and then also some concerns of whether the board would be under the OLCC or its own separate agency. And since I understand now that the House bill is moving, I'll speak with Rep. Williamson and anyone else with the bill involved on that side, so we can maybe hopefully work those issues out before it comes to the Senate.
Okay, questions? All right, got off easy. OLCC have any issue?
For the record, Jesse Sweet, policy analyst with OLCC. In summary, no, we do not have any issues. I'd like to speak briefly to the Dash 3s. This moves
direction. There's a Dash 3?
There is.
Oh, okay.
This moves the direct shipper permits to quarterly reporting. What a direct shipper permit does is it allows an out-of-state entity to ship wine directly to an Oregon consumer. They're currently required by statute to report monthly. We have approximately 1,100 monthly reporters on a manual paper process that generates very little tax revenue relative to the work in processing the reports. So by going to the quarterly reporting, we would ease the burden on OLCC staff as we move towards an automated reporting process, hopefully sometime in the future. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about the Dash 3s or any other portion of the bill.
I'm trying to deal from memory here, Jesse, but I think this was one of the ideas that came up during the task force, the bill in general, wasn't it?
Chair Beyer, that's correct.
Okay. Any questions of Jesse? Sina, thank you very much. Anybody else wishes to testify? Okay, I think we're going to let this one percolate for a couple of weeks for the other things to catch up with it. So we will close the public hearing on... Excuse me?
Michael McCrane.
583. And is Amy around?
She might have thought you were done with those bills.
No. She asked to come back.
Oh, did she?
No. She's her partner just did that. So we got to keep track of that.
Where the others
gotcha.
Are.
Hold on here just a second.
We'll wait.
Oh, down.
Here we are.
I think we got done quicker than Amy thought.
That's all we got left, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't want to cover for?
Did we do the window tinting thing already?
We did. How'd that come out?
Amy's got a hearing.
Yeah.
No, it was just
a hearing.
Yeah, just
okay.
A hearing.
We're very efficient.
Well, I can do it.
You could do it?
I can make some of them.
Yeah, why should this be any different?
Absolutely. Maybe Mr. Kosasan could do the next one.
Why don't we stand at ease here? Okay, we'll go back into order, and we will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bills 461 and 463. And you want to take 461 first?
Yes, Chair Byron, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. On Senate Bill 461, there's testimony posted on OLIS. Just a couple of items on this bill, which would have DMV allow folks to have a new photograph when they come in to get a replacement photo due to disliking their current photo. So in 2010 or so, DMV implemented a bill passed by the legislature regarding biometric checks. So this has to do with taking the photograph of a person, subjecting it to computer algorithms, and what it does is check against all the other photographs in the DMV database. It has to do with protecting against fraud and ID theft. That's important to this because it is a bit of an explanation about how DMV has changed how it deals with photographs. Because of that biometric checking, up until January of 2014, DMV deemed it to be pretty critical to require a new photograph when people get a replacement license. People update their photos, they're subjected to the biometric checking, it helps with identity theft and fraud protection. But over the course of time, determined that DMV could gain a lot of efficiency by stopping that, by going back to the process of just using the old photograph on file when a person gets a replacement license. They've lost it, it's been destroyed, that sort of thing. So weighed the benefit, the biometric checking, against the efficiencies and determined that really there were a great deal of efficiency that could be made by going back to this old system of reusing the old photo. About 145,000 people a year get a replacement license. So when you add up all the time that's spent with doing the photo and the other activity around that, DMV determined they save the equivalent of about three positions. That's a lot of efficiency, and that's a lot of time that the people at the counter can now spend on other activities and try to do what we can to hold down wait times. Probably the number one complaint DMV gets is wait times. So what we see in this bill is taking a step back from that effort towards efficiency, which DMV is always trying to do to make those efforts, to try to get at the constant struggle against high wait times. And so what DMV would do to implement this bill, if it were to pass, is to create a process where if a person received their plastic driver license in the mail and determined at some time before the 8-year renewal that they didn't like that photo any longer, they could come in, ask for a replacement with a new photo, turn in the plastic so we don't have multiple plastic cards floating around, and be able to get the new photograph. That's how we would implement it. But it would be taking a step back from the efficiencies that we've gained.
Well, I assume you would charge them the cost of reissuing the license, which would be higher than a normal license.
Chair Beyer, almost all of DMV's fees are set in statute. Mm-hmm. This fee is as well. And I can tell you that DMV did a cost versus fee study just about 2 years ago and determined that a number of fees that are charged, that are set in statute, do not even cover costs. The issuance and replacement of a driver license is one of those where we lose money on every transaction. And as Tom McClellan, our administrator, likes to say, you can't make that up in volume. So it's a money loser for us. Fees are always an issue as we talk about things like transportation packages and that sort of thing. So that is something where if, as Senator Przanski suggested, that there be a new fee or an additional fee, that would be a welcome addition to this bill, I think.
Senator?
Yeah, the question I have, is there any policy as to showing the person the picture before it goes to print? Because it seems like I've had it both ways, where one time they just took the picture, looked at it, and says, oh, it's good. And then I had somebody says, oh, this is pretty good. What do you think? Uh-huh. I like the latter more than the former. And it seems like that would eliminate a lot of the complaints right here.
Yeah.
Because I got a picture one time that wasn't too swift. But
you mean it looked like you?
Yeah, it sort of did. Yeah. I knew that was coming. Yeah.
Good job. Chair Beyer and Senator Girod, two things on that. I will say that there is an element of this where much smaller field offices, and I think probably your home field office is one of the smaller ones, may provide that kind of extra level of customer service to folks when there isn't a queue of people in the lobby. In other places where you've got people out the door, an hour wait, I would suggest to you that in those offices, that's probably not going to be offered. And in terms of putting that into any kind of policy or that kind of thing, all of that stuff, all of those things just add to the time that the transaction takes. If you take all, you know, if you got your, what are we doing, licenses, maybe about $600,000 or $700,000 a year, and every one of them you're showing the picture, offering a second or a third photo. All of that stuff just adds up. And in it, I refer to DMV as a widget organization, right? On some level, it's a factory. You're putting out a lot of product and dealing with a lot of customers with a very limited set of customer service representatives and a limited set of resources. So all of those things we take into consideration. How much time does it take? And while it seems like it doesn't take, you know, but maybe 10, 15, 30 seconds a minute, it all adds up.
So if somebody loses their license, mm-hmm. the original is just sort of printed off from file, or do they take a new picture?
Chair Beyer, it does require a visit to the field office, but yes, it's just printed off.
Don't take another photo?
Correct. I think that's the gist of this, of the change here and the suggestion in the bill.
Senator Thompson?
Getting back to the fee thing of doing that, replacing, can you set it high enough to cover your costs? And then maybe the price of that, even it's really not what it's for, but that could deter a lot of people from doing it. But what do you know the cost that would be?
Chair Beyer,
it wasn't enough, but what would that number be?
Chair Beyer and Senator
Thompson.
If
you're fully recovering the cost.
Yeah.
I'd have to take a look at our fiscal, and unfortunately, I've misplaced my file. I apologize. I think it is about...
Coming up.
Here it comes.
We know where it is.
I have a fantastic manager. Thank you so much. I believe the difference is about $5 or $6 from where we are now, which is under cost, to getting up to the actual cost, the fully loaded cost for what it takes to do this thing.
Follow up? But you said it would take an extra three FTEs per year, three FTEs to do this program.
No, that's not what she said.
I think that's what you said.
Chair Beyer and Senator Thompson, I apologize if I misspoke. When we went from taking a new picture every single time to almost never taking a new picture, that was the three FTE savings. I am not in any way saying that implementing this proposal in the bill would take three FTE, absolutely not.
So $5 or $6 would not, if you would only...
Wouldn't be a deterrent.
Wouldn't be enough to be a deterrent, but...
I don't believe so, no, Chair Beyer. And it would raise the fee for well, if we were to do that, that's on everybody's
You're just saying
license.
that the cost of the current driver's license is about $5 or $6 less than what it actually costs DMV to do it, to issue
Chair Beyer, that's correct.
So if you were to double that, Senator Dryden.
Yeah, the problem I have. Sorry.
No, that's no.
The problem I have is your driver's license is used for ID you know, pretty universally, you don't take a concealed weapons permit ID very often. So I think your picture is somewhat important, and that's why I go back to the initial picture that you had taken. You just, you know, it just seems like it's 30 seconds. What do you think of this? And you give them two shots at the apple, and that's good. But that you think that that would cause a lot of more personnel having to be hired if they did that in the bigger areas?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, if we call it 30 seconds on average and we multiply that by 750,000 transactions, it gets up there pretty quick.
It would, yeah, okay.
Well, I wonder if there's a middle ground here where if you were setting a fee, like doubling it or something like that for a convenience refotoing, if that would, for those who really want one, could we let you just go off and talk with your manager and think about that and see if there's a number there that might work and how we might deal with that?
Chair Beyer, I'd be happy to talk to the folks at DMV who crunch numbers and let you know what.
I would be personally would be unwilling to pass this legislation without fully recovering the cost, and I think you're underestimating the cost of doing something special here. And there's a little convenience factor. I mean, it's akin to a vanity plate. Well, it is. What? I mean, it can really be different. I think of my daughter whose hair changes all the time, and style. I don't know. Okay, so anything else on this one? I would like you to come back and talk to me, and if you have some options there,
certainly.
See if we can come up, and what
certainly
it would take in terms of changing it to get there. So you want to move to, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 461. And we will now move to 463, which is also open.
Chair Beyer, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I had not planned to testify on this bill, and so find myself somewhat unprepared to do so, but I would be happy to try to answer any questions the committee may have for the department on the bill.
Okay. The question I would have would be similar to what the chair was asking. Is there a way that we could put on your registration fee? So, like, you have a household, and you have an individual, and I could use myself. I get migraine headaches, so dark tint would be nice, but my wife drives the same car. So is there any way that we could cover both individuals so that we could have tinting on our windows?
And, Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, if I can ask a question, do you mean, are you referring to a fee or to some kind of designation on the registration?
Just a
designation.
I think we were talking about a designation
okay.
up here.
Well, here's the issue we're dealing with. Municipal Judge Ellen, I get where he's getting at, saying, you know, you can do this, you can have the exception, but the problem becomes when you put tinted windows on a car, they're on the car, and then when somebody else, your spouse or somebody else is driving it, they're kind of like, well, you don't, that doesn't really apply. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that if we're going to allow that, that we probably need a way to officially designate it for the car, and the one that makes the most sense is somehow indicating it on the registration. But I guess I don't want to prescribe a way to do that. I'm looking to DMV to think about that and say, is there a way to do that? Maybe it is just a letter on file in the car, but I'd hate to jump to that. Senator Riley?
Mr. Chair, I keep reading the law, and that maybe is my problem. But the person who installs this tinting material gives the owner a certificate stating then the name and address of the person who installed the tint, the light transmittance, the light reflectance, and this certificate that, you know, they did it under the law. And if that certificate is in the car, we already have to carry the registration and proof of insurance. I don't see why people who have this certificate don't just carry that with the registration and proof of insurance. I don't see why we need anything more.
Senator Thompson?
Well, I would think if you have tinted windows and a sheriff or a state cop pulls up behind you and runs your, he's going to pull you over because you got tinted windows, so he's going to take his time to do that. If he had it on his record somewhere, that when they ask their dispatchers about that license number, it's going to show up that they're allowed to have tinted windows. Otherwise, they're going to get pulled over.
Well, that's true.
And you're going to have to stop and check. You know, it'll take
that's
time.
True.
It might
that's
be
true.
Legal, but...
Well, the fact that a municipal judge is bringing this to our attention, which I think where he's probably coming from is saying this is a waste of the court's time to be dealing with these.
That's why.
But that doesn't solve the problem of when you got his and her both driving the same car and one of them needs it tinted and one of them doesn't.
Well, it could.
You
if
just
it was on the registration because that information, I think, would pull up. I don't know. You know, rather than guessing here, gentlemen, why don't we ask Amy to, you hear our concerns, could you ask your techies to think that one and come back and give us a recommendation?
Chair Byer would be happy to do that.
That makes a lot more sense.
Can we add one thing?
Yes.
How many states allow tinting? Because we're not the only state, so let's find out. How others do it. It might be that you just allow tinting and be done with it.
Well, the tinting, I think, is primarily for the safety of the public safety people.
Well, they say, but you can have tinting on all your windows except your front windows.
Yeah, I don't think you can have it on the back.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, you can.
Except the front. Well, I don't know. Anyway, we're speculating.
I'll get back to the committee with that information. All those issues.
All righty. So, is anybody else? We've got it open. Anybody else who wants to speak on 463?
I think you should encourage her to wear tennis shoes next time because I saw her run from green room F all the way up here.
My apologies for holding the committee up. I apologize.
No apologies necessary. You made it. We'll close on 463. That's it for the day. Is there anything else? We are adjourned.
Great. Great.